take session number 18493, reel 23.
Mr. Lupton, reel 23. Looking at when you were first made up to Lance Sergeant, how did your fellow sergeants take to you?
Well, most of them by that time I had known quite a while, and even the ones who were slightly above sergeant, maybe not RSM, but that was a bit different. He was nearly an officer sort of thing, and separate really from everybody else, but sergeants, staff sergeants and so on. As I say, I'd known them for quite a while by that time. They'd known me, and you weren't really specifically downgraded in the mess because you were a Lance Sergeant. You were just part of the sergeants and upwards, non-commissioned officers. And we all got on very well, I think. And I can't remember any way that anybody looked down on you or otherwise.
How about the reverse? I mean, how much support and help or advice and that sort of thing was the forthcoming?
Oh, it was all quite friendly, and where you needed a bit of advice on what to do when and all this kind of thing, it was quite freely and without any holdbacks was given to you, so that when you had to take different parades or deal with different things, you were assisted as far as possible by somebody either from the same squadron or from one of the other squadrons. You used to mix more in, of course you did in there, so that you weren't any sort of C squadron born and bred or whatever. You just got absorbed into the family almost.
What about advice that you didn't know that you needed? Did anybody sort of proffer some of that, sort of suggest that you might be doing something a different way?
I never recall any special difficulty in any job. Everything seemed, mind you, we had been under people like that for so long that you sort of already had it in you to deal as you should, and there wasn't really very much that you needed to take in as extra, apart from if you were taking somebody up for a, not a court-martial, but for some misdemeanor, then you had to watch your step as you did it correctly, but otherwise, no. And anyway, then you usually got the Sergeant Major who would be taking over the main control of it.
What was the most difficult thing with your three stripes?
Well, I suppose in a way it was making sure that you controlled more rigidly people that you had been generally friendly with, not quite on the same footing, but I mean, when you got as far as corporal, you were still only a little way up the ladder, and so people were more personally connected with you or to you. When you got up to sergeant, you became a different kind of animal in a way, with your own mess, well, your own mess when you were any situated anywhere and not still out on the tanks or something. And they felt you were just a degree further away from you. You had to keep good contact with them, but at the same time learn how to control them and order them about and so on.
And that, of course, is the whole point of the discipline element. What was discipline like in the second?
Well, it was quite strict in that there were certain things laid down which you should or shouldn't do. But on the other hand, it was not strict by virtue of being impressive or oppressive, rather. Most people did eventually, or not in not too long a time really, learn, if say, to behave themselves and do what they should at the appropriate times. I mean, outside, not the camp so much, because we weren't in camp very much. But outside in off-duty times, they could behave slightly more freely, but at the same time not be ground down into a rigid form, still to be themselves.
Wondering about the famous or perhaps infamous bull. Was there an awful lot of that with the second?
Well, in a lot of our time, no. But when we settled into a routine in a camp of some kind, then it wasn't oppressive. It didn't force you to polish your boots until you could see your face in them or your belt buckles or whatever. But you did have to keep reasonably smart while you were walking around or doing whatever you were supposed to be doing. And generally, most people seem to fit in with that, or it fitted in with their requirements generally.
Another thing one hears an awful lot about from units that had spent a long time in the Middle East, and in the desert in particular, was, shall we say, a casualness towards official army dress, and you know, things like desert boots and flamboyant scarves and things like this. Was this something that that the second went in for?
Yes, plenty of it. I have still, I think, several photographs showing myself and others in definitely non, well, they were military in that they had been issued generally, apart from those which people picked up in the Italian campaign, which was every kind of Italian dress from field marshals downwards, I think. But it was pretty free and easy, except when you were on some official parade. You could, whether you wore a shirt or not, or socks, had your boots polished, or just put a cap comforter on your head instead of a beret or something, okay, never mind. You just walked around like that, or ambled around, or whatever.
And that only changed, as you say, when you settled down and went. You were in a sort of static situation in a camp or something.
Yes, yes, that was the case. We did sometimes, of course, have a week or two, or maybe a little more, in some position out in the desert, parked indiscriminately across the desert to defy the Stukas and so on. In those cases, well, even then, you, unless you had to go on parade for something, you still ambled around in whatever you felt like, and turned up in the afternoon to go, if you were within reach of the beach, to go for a swim or something.
Did this apply as much to the officers as to the other ranks?
I would say so. They usually had a little more regular dress sense, let's say, than most of the others. The others didn't matter which rank they were, more or less, unless, as I say, you were Squadron Sergeant Major or RSM, about how you dressed and walked about. But officers and the upper warrant officers would be more regularly dressed anyway.
How about the officers in general? What was the relationship on a very general basis between officers as men and the second?
Well, in the main, it was friendly, but you still had, at that time, I don't know whether it still applies, you still had to sort of address them as Mr. or Captain or whatever the name was. Or say, sir, when you were talking to them. But otherwise, when they were living and eating and generally together with their tank crews or with the lorry, echelon, whatever, they were friendly, chatted just normally. Everybody could put up with them, or put up with each other, should I say.
Yes, you said earlier that there was a distinct difference as the war went on between the type of officer. I mean, were the relations different between the long-serving regular officers and the hostilities-only officers?
I would say the regular officers from earlier on were, what would you say, perhaps a little snooty towards the ones who came in later on. The ones who didn't have the correct public school pronunciation or whatever. But it was, after a while, I think, they mingled more when they got to know each other and how they behaved, both in the mess and out in the field. Then I think it generally became more evenly balanced between them.
What about the difference? Was there a discernible difference between the way the relationships between other ranks and officers, between the two types of officer?
No, the newer ones who talked with Lancashire or East End or whatever accent were still treated really the same way as the other regular officers who'd been there for a while, or those who came through later on, who had been to the right schools and so on.
I suppose inevitably, remembering your comments about a delightful Finn officer called Split Pin, I mean, one inevitably has the question, what about regimental characters? Do you have any recollection of any particular officer or other characters that might have made a great impression?
Well, there were a few who did, such as the CEO we had for quite a while, John, I think it was, George Yule, I forget at the moment. He was with us. He was an officer we had in C Squadron, I think. A Major Zacharias from Liverpool, who was quite a character. Strong rugby player too, and joined us out on the field many a time. We had one or two in C Squadron too earlier on. Juma. I'm sorry, it's going a bit too far back to remember. Rudkin, Mark Rudkin. Yes. And of course, John Bonham Carter, who was second in command for a while, and who I met after the war too. And yes, there were. It's ridiculous. Plum. No. Sorry. names are missing at the moment. I can see faces, but putting a name to them is difficult.
I was just really thinking about any particular characteristics of any of these individuals.
Well, as I say, the Zacharias Major, he was typical Liverpudlian, but quite amusing, as they so often are, and forthright in his speech, which could be interspersed with a lot of Liverpudlian forms. And the George Yule, who was our CO for a while, I know we were cooking a meal once and had at that time we had jerry cans for something, we'd picked them up somewhere. And he drilled a hole in one and lit the fumes as they came out of the petrol and put that underneath your pans you were cooking. You just stopped him by sort of banging your hand up against the hole eventually. But one day our jerry can exploded and went flying over his tank just as he was getting in over the top. And a very ordinary comment about it. I forget just what it was, the exact wording, but yeah, that was a near one sort of thing, you know. He didn't bother. Half a flaming can flying over his head. Various things like that. One of our people also invented the compass, the daytime. Oh, so it was just a desert compass, we called it, which wasn't a compass at all, really. It had a an upright pin and numbers around the scale, and you just sort of headed off for that and took account of how far the sun was going around, and which was very useful in the desert because there weren't an awful lot of signs that you could pick up, or, you know, different shaped hills or whatever. Although I have driven from A to B on several occasions without needing to refer to special features, apart from you just recognise that that hill had one twig on it or something that another one didn't. But not everybody who first came out to the desert realized that these things existed. Couldn't follow them up so easily. Anyway, yes, it's very awkward to think of special features about several of them. They all had some, but it was very difficult to pinpoint what they were. There was one of our cooks once in when we were near Baghdad, and he'd gone in the morning to light the fires and get the oven going and so on, which was just a heap of tin cans put on end and then blow a flame underneath. And he forgot that he'd opened up the fuel supply and was looking around for matches. When he eventually found one and lit it, the whole cookhouse blew up, and he fortunately only got a bit of a blast in the chest from something, which didn't do him any serious harm at all, just bruised him a bit. He was extremely lucky. Yeah. These things happen occasionally.
Coming back now to your work with the regiment, you came back to the regiment, you said, beginning of 1944, very beginning, January 1st, 2nd, or whatever it was of 1944.
Yes.
You started putting your particular training into practice. I remember we dealt with that. What was the next thing that happened?
Well, it wasn't very long that we were still parked around in near Baghdad. They started to pack up and to get ready for packing up and to clear the camp and to move off. And we went, the tanks, mainly the ones that we had, were sent off by rail, or some, I think, went on tank transporters, not on their own tracks, because we were going too far. The other vehicles went off across a track over the desert, which took us eventually into Palestine, as it was then. And I remember I was sitting on a 3-ton truck with the man, he was driving it. Ours was full of kit bags. And just as a break, I took over the driving for a bit. And we were then going down the Jordan Valley sides when we were going down a very hectic road with hairpin bends and so on, going down to the Jordan and then up the other side, when I couldn't push the brake down to do any good, and there was a terrible smell, which I found later when we got to the bottom was a burst hydraulic pipe for the brake operation. So I had to do, well, if you put a handbrake on those things, the handbrake used to clamp onto the driving shaft. So if you put it on too much, of course, you just about rip the driving shaft off the engine, or the other way around. So we had to do that gently and then gradually change down until eventually I managed to get down to second gear, I think. But we were going at a heck of a pace even before that. Anyway, we got to the bottom of the hill and across the Jordan without any severe damage, apart from having no foot brake on the thing. Which fortunately we managed to get cleared up by the fitters when they came up, put a new bit of pipe in. But it was quite a long drive because we went from near Baghdad down to the Suez end of the Suez Canal, just the Red Sea end of the Suez Canal, before we eventually parked up and set up a bit of a camp where we were going to do various kinds of training, and where there was a big escarpment of hills behind us to give us a bit of exercise climbing hills, and we were right alongside the sea, so we could just plunge into the water first thing in the morning. Beautiful place, actually. And we were fairly near to a German prisoner of war camp, which we had to do a bit of guard duty on occasionally.
Can you remember the name of the place?
I can't. No, it's not Ismailia. It was somewhere that's more in the middle of the canal. No. I may have it written down somewhere, but I fear I cannot at the moment.
No problem.
Or it may be even be in the history.
You were saying off the tape that there was some local leave instituted early in 1944. Did you take advantage of that?
Yes, I went up to have a week in Alexandria. I was staying one of the pensions or guest houses or whatever you like to call them in that area. I had an invitation by my father, who was a member of the not round table, the other
Rotary
in his hometown, Wallington, near Croydon, and he had asked somebody at the Alexandria Rotary if they could look out for me, and the man very kindly took me along to one of their Rotary lunches, and I met with his family and daughter and so on. They were Egyptian, Coptic Egyptians, who lived in the town part of Alexandria, and I always thought it was quite a nice area around there anyway. More interesting than Cairo, probably because it had the sea and so on. With some other sergeants, I played tennis there and so on. We had quite a good time. And I had additionally been corresponding with a girl who, it came quite by accident when I was in India, I think, and my father had sent some money out. And it came through in a telegram, through some telegraph office in Egypt. How it came through there, I have no idea, but it eventually came to me. And I'd been corresponding with one of the girls whose name was on this telegram. And she was actually in Alexandria then, in the Wrens. I forget just what she was then, but she did become lieutenant later on and so on. But anyway, we met whilst we were there, went and had a couple of meals out somewhere, a place which I'd found before, which was quite pleasant. And so in all, it was quite a pleasant holiday period. And then back to camp to work again.
Was there much to do in Alexandria, or was it just the, as you say, just the fact that it was pleasant and quiet?
Well, really, it was pleasant and quiet, yes. And the sea, mind you, at that time of the year, the sea's not fair.